Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have a distinct perspective on time.
Welcome to episode 40 of Time Sensitive. On this episode, Andrew's in conversation with the artist Dan Colin. What'd you guys talk about?
Well, first of all, we should thank him for coming into the studio amidst a global pandemic. But he was in town to launch a project with Dover Street Market related to one half of his sort of life, Sky High Farm, which is this extraordinary farm in upstate New York that he's had for about 10 years, which does some incredible work with food justice. All of their yield goes to people in need. And they're really beginning now, after the first decade, to expand into some really interesting areas. But the other half of his life is that he's this, you know, global scale artist and has an incredibly strong practice and has exhibited, obviously, around the world.
By Gagosian.
Yeah, so we get into this dual life of farming and art making. And we also do a bit of time on the legendary kind of early days in downtown New York, where he was really at the center of what is now called the Bowery School, which is really a part of New York history that's very close to my heart. And, you know, I find it so interesting to speak to someone who is so extraordinarily successful, not in one career, but in two, who based all of his choices on instinct, not really on strategy, kind of goes with what he feels is the right thing to do in that moment in time. And I really wanted to get to the bottom of a bit of that and his perspective on life.
I think we could all be following instinct a little bit more these days.
Yeah.
Before we get into it, though, I first want to thank our season three sponsor, the German watchmaker Alanga & Zuna. One of the things I like so much about Alanga & Zuna is that they're driven by experimentation. There's just like such an incredible dedication to craft, to what they do. And this approach is evident in so many of the different timepieces that they put out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like Dan, actually, this experimentation. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever spent time with Dan's work, whether the paintings or the sculpture, they are crafted so beautifully. Mm. This sort of attention. So it's actually quite fitting that Longa is sponsoring this episode. To speak a bit about some of the watches that Longa makes that we've learned about, one of them that we really like is the Richard Longa Perpetual Calendar. They call it the Terra Luna, which has this orbital moon phase display that enables people to sort of track the alignment of the Earth, the moon, the sun. Mm-hmm. That's probably the one I'd like to wear the most.
Another that I think is worth highlighting is the recently released Turbograph Perpetual Honey Gold. This is part of the homage to FAA Longa collection and features five complications. So there's a tourbillon, a Fuchsian chain, a chronograph, a retrepont, and a perpetual calendar. There's 684 individual parts in the movement of this watch.
Which the level of intricacy is like insane if
crazy.
You take a look at this
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, I mean, just incredible artistry.
And also in some of the newer work, like there's this collection, the Zeitwerk collection, which we just saw, which combines this kind of digital style display with this beautifully finished manually wound caliber at the heart of it. So, you know, it's one of these companies that whether they're doing something like pushing the envelope on classical watchmaking or working on more contemporary expressive work, they really bring this truly artful presence to everything they make. So I encourage you to learn more about the company. You can check out their website at alange-soehne.com.
And now here's Andrew with Dan.
Welcome, Dan. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're in town to launch a project with Dover Street.
Yeah.
Cool. Tell me a bit about it. How did it come to be?
I mean, you know, to talk about this project is to kind of like talk about the whole farm. We just 501c3'd, became a nonprofit a few months ago. It's a license that we had for for several years and it was about to expire, you know. You have to kind of like define how you use it. We you know, it'd been in its own entity, but we hadn't been putting any money into it. We had never taken any donations. And I just like, for a long time, I didn't know how to talk about this project, you know. It's just a new world for me in so many ways when it started 9 years ago. But when we were discussing whether or not to become a public nonprofit, the idea of being a kind of charitable business came up. And at that point, we just started discussing products. And I realized that, like, I wanted to start talking about things. I didn't want to just talk about it. I wanted to offer a opportunity for people to support and then figure out their own conversations around it. And the lightest touch seemed to be through products. So we started making honey and jam. In doing that, you know, we came up with like labeling and, you know, like really branding. I worked with an amazing illustrator, Joanna, and we came up with this like really cool thing. I got excited about it. And I guess what I started realizing at the time, you know, I grew up skateboarding. A lot of my friends have been in streetwear and, you know, grew up around Supreme. And I just understood that I had somehow accidentally created this very unique thing that was very timely. I see so many brands now trying to carry a message, you know, and use the message as kind of like their face in a way. But when you peel it off, it's just a capitalist, kind of like a basic capitalist mechanism, you know, whatever it is, whatever they're selling. And, you know, I realized I had this thing and we could use it, you know, we could create these covetable objects that were used to fundraise. I reached out to Dover Street and I went in there and they thought it was cool. I was honestly amazed that they kind of took to it, but we started working on it and they understood that it was about my mission and it was about education and advocacy. And, you know, they offered me an opportunity to really kind of like have some space and time. And we set up some panel discussions and, you know, they were very supportive, but they were never going to participate in the charitable part of it. It was never the plan. But as we worked on it, you know, halfway through it, they reached out and were like, you know what, like, we really want to be a part of this. And they really just got sucked into it, you know, and I kind of watched it happen and it was encouraging. We created some apparel, you know, t-shirts and hoodies, all made on vintage stock. And we partnered with all of our different food banks that we work with to kind of carry their message. So we made a shirt for Food Bank for New York City and Regional Food Bank and some other organizations we work with. After that project, they became very supportive and we started imagining a bigger version of it where we were collaborating with other brands. And it got stalled by COVID, but you know, like a month into it, we started talking about it again. And I think I had become much more engaged in the farm's work because it's so relevant, you know, and more important than ever. As important as ever, it's just there's more opportunity now because so many more people are listening and talking, right?
Yeah.
The last 6 months, we've been designing this really large-scale project. And, you know, I mean, we've been working with like amazing people and top to bottom, everybody is kind of like donating their time, energy, and creativity, from Supreme to Denim Tears and Total Luxury Spa, Noah. It's just like all of these great Awake. Designers, Awake, Iraq, really amazing people who have been a big part of it. Awake in particular has really kind of like helped me on many levels. We've worked on a small documentary around the project and he came with me on some food donations. And, you know, we're working on a project this weekend with a smile and an amazing restaurant in the Bronx called La Mirada. So Angelo's really kind of like really helped and being a big part of it, but everybody has been really involved. So it's been, you know, kind of touching, honestly, to just kind of like start this thing with this pretty big community of people that I've known for a long time and just
mission aligned.
Yes. Mission aligned and just available.
How did you come to go from essentially just focusing on art your whole life to having a farm?
Yeah. I mean, all these questions are really tough because like I'm in a moment where, and I'm sure like everybody is out there, I'm like really, I'm really seeing the big picture, you know? And like, there's no way to explain how really through life, you know, like one thing happened, another thing happened. I mean, you know, you talk about time and the reason why I moved upstate is because I got sober then. That kind of shift in lifestyle brings on a lot of questions and ideas around time. I ended up there because of that, but with no intention of farming or you know, stewarding the land in any way, or having, or, you know, dealing with animals or food in any way, or dealing with food justice in any way, you know. So how it really happened is the same way that everything happens for me in my professional life. I have ideas. I try to stay sensitive to the world around me and try to have faith in these ideas and realizing them into objects or moments or performances or images. They start in inexplicable places, you know, in abstract places and fantastic places, and they don't necessarily end up in any different places. But, you know, as an artist, that's really what's happening in the most basic way. I have an idea, and it's whether or not I can latch onto it and have the faith to go through the motions to realize it. And I know that what happens in that space and time is transformative, right? Yeah. Like what's in my mind is never going to come out. So it's really a matter of faith, you know, and I'm going to discover something. You know, I think the other thing that's very important to it is then I go and share that. This farm happened in the same way because like there was no R&D, you know, ever, right?
Yeah.
I think it's important that we get to talking about the relationship between small-scale farming and food justice, which are so important.
Yeah.
But I had like zero clue of that, you know, when I started this. It was very intuitive. And, you know, so looking back, you know, I had this idea, which I honestly couldn't even tell you what it was anymore, similar to many of the artworks that I've made. But I know that it started with some idea that had nothing to do with what we're looking at here, you know. And the farm is really no different. I think it's a unique farm and it has a unique voice in food justice. And I think it's because of that, because it was built through faith, not through research or intention or immediate experience. And there was a lot of those things along the way. You know, there's a lot of intentionality that like comes into it. And there's a lot of experience that feeds into it. But like, it was really just kind of following, you know, an instinct. Very recently, you know, how I've kind of like come to like own it in a new way and trying to build it in a new way is, you know, for a long time, there was this dilemma where it was like, where is my energy going? Where is my money going? Into the art, into the farm, you know, and it was very confusing.
Yeah.
Do I really know what I'm doing here with the farm, with the farming itself, with the politics and the social justice and the policy? And, you know, should I be doing this? And at a certain point, I decided that like, it's, the dilemma isn't real. You know, like I'm creating a narrative, but like I'm an artist. That's all that I am. You know, as an artist, I am searching for new experiences and new ways to kind of share, you know, my ideas and my relationship to the world I'm living in. And this is just a part of it, you know?
Absolutely.
And obviously there's a lot of art historical examples in social justice and the kind of social sphere. And you know, even in farming, but regardless, like, I just have stopped worrying about the boundaries between—
Is that recent? Is that COVID?
It's super recent. And, you know, like, I've really, in a way, the farm and the work we do has been, it's not an autopilot. I put a lot of work into it, but, like, we kind of established our growing style and, you know, how we're working our land, and we've established the relationships with the organizations we donate to. And, you know, like the farmer could handle a lot of the work. And in the last 6 months, I've really like stepped into a role of like, you know, it's kind of transitioning from like an executive director into like a board president, but like really dug in, speaking to a lot of people and really trying to kind of like grow the scale of our impact, but also just refine the way in which we are operating, both on the land and in the communities we work to serve.
Well, food systems and the food crisis has never been more relevant than in the last 6 months, 7 months. People are seeing it firsthand and feeling it firsthand.
Yeah.
And the idea of local and a sort of disconnected global coordination that didn't happen with food, you know, you start to realize this is locally produced for the people that need it in the immediate area, and they're given the food for free. When I started looking at it, I realized there were so many relationships between the work you've made and this. It's another art project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's built to shift perception. It's built to be a model. It's built to be a mirror. And there's a lot in there I want to get into. So much of your work, and I imagine in your farming, has something to do with this sort of drifting or fading of time. It's like this ephemerality and this consistent change, you know, even in a a solid image that you've created, you feel a sense of before, and then there's a moment about to happen.
Yeah.
How has the farming sort of shifted your relationship to time? Because it is all about time.
My early work is very much about freezing a moment and trying to hold on to that moment. You know, there's the first paintings that I made, which are these interiors, photorealist interior spaces. I always thought of them as paintings of light. They each have a very kind of prominent light source. And, you know, light is constantly shifting, right? Like whether it's the sun or electric light, it's all buzzing. And so to kind of capture the way a room is lit just felt like very much about capturing a hyper, like microscopic moment. Mm-hmm. It was so much about that. And I tied feelings to that, like how feelings change just as kind of frequently. And I wanted to capture that. The next paintings, I made these candle paintings and it was smoke. And so the smoke kind of formed these words, which could only ever exist for this kind of like split second. So it was kind of about freezing that time. What shifted eventually in certain ways slowly because I started making paintings with non-traditional materials, and something like gum, clearly it would deteriorate and it was an unstable material. It wasn't so much about that. But after the gum, is actually right when I went up to the country to finish my first show that I did at Rivington Arms, because I just couldn't finish it here and I needed to kind of get out. And that was in 2002. In 2010, right before my first big show at Gagosian, I went back up to the same place. It's a friend of mine's property close to Hunter Mountain in Greene County. Again, I didn't go up there with this intention, but I started using the kind of natural elements to make work. And that's where I kind of came up with the idea for the flower paintings. When I started making the flower paintings, you know, they are about like death and beauty. They are about the impossibility of things lasting. And art is the thing that we try to use to defy that, right? I mean, nothing is maintained with the same commitment as art, you know, partly because it becomes commodity. But, you know, I think that there's a kind of more sentimental kind of reasons behind.
No, there's more than that.
There is more than that. The experience of it is something I believe in deeply.
How interested in your own history are you now? And I don't just mean your own lived history, also pre-birth sort of generational history. And how are you thinking about time in that way?
All right. Well, you keep on asking these questions, which like are like their own podcasts all in and of themselves. Just jumping, you know, the flower paintings, you know, they cannot last, right? You know, yeah. They slowly disappear is really what happens. I think that the art doesn't disappear. They transform, you know? And that's really what happens. Things transform, you know, whether we turn into dust, we turn into wind, we turn into, you know, the air, we continuously transform. So right now I'm actually like what my big focus is, and it's not like quite active in a way. I'm trying to figure out how to produce a large scale performance. There's like a script that looks like the script of a play. It's three acts and there's like a narrative arc, but it's very absurdist and it's very much about bodies and movement. Mm. And there's dialogue and characters. And I use this kind of legendary unreleased Jerry Lewis movie as a kind of like a point of departure for it. The movie's called The Day the Clown Cried and is set in a Nazi concentration camp. I'm Jewish, and, you know, my work is always kind of considered that. Sometimes I consider myself through other people and through their identities, and over time, I've become more and more interested in kind of looking directly at myself.
Yeah.
And then through that, I become more and more interested in looking at, like, exactly what you bring up. The way in which my ancestry, like, affects me in this moment, really, yeah. You know, and that's really, like, my concern is, like, what's happening in this moment?
Did you grow up with a Jewish kind of household or Jewish identity?
I grew up not with a religious household, but like my parents were both born in Brooklyn, very close to each other, both in Brownsville, but like my mother more with the Italians, although she's Jewish, and my father really in like what was like a shtetl in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. You know, really like a yeshiva kid. This is like in the late 1930s, early 1940s. So, and, you know, Judaism, the culture of it really shaped our lives. And like, I would say the Holocaust really shaped his life and his relationship to just being a part of helping to, you know, make sure that there are Jews in the world and that they're safe became a big part of his life. But, you know, much less religious, much more cultural. I mean, when we speak about time, it's about what lasts through it, right? What travels through it. And it's a conduit, right? The time isn't affecting us. It's like what lasts, what is able to be transmitted through time is affecting us, right? Time in and of itself is this kind of abstract thing, but many things, and so these things are invisible, right? Because we can't see the tube of time. I'm interested in that transmission, those invisible transmissions. And in general, as an artist, you know, that's what I'm doing. I believe that like artists can transmit an energy or a power or a potency into an object. It's not necessarily something that they themselves have created. They're another kind of tool that can be a part of that process. But the endpoint is an object that has a power, that has a life to it. And I'm interested in that transmission. And I see this transmission through ancestry, or, you know, ancestry just being one example of ways in which time, you know, kind of transmits experience. That's kind of like my interest. And like, that's really what this play is about.
Mm.
And, you know, I think trauma is maybe the easiest, you know, kind of most palpable way to consider that. But like just one of a million ways. There's obviously, you know, a lot of joyous transmission, but then just like all the subtleties, you know, yeah. Really everything. And I'm just kind of curious.
Well, there are marks that seem to stick, you know, and marks are also something that I've noticed throughout your work. I was remembering walking onto the skateboard ramp. I think it's called the Bridge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that the name?
I think it was called Overture.
Overture.
Yeah, but it was like a bridge.
But I remember looking up and seeing the skids from the skateboard wheels, and it was about a moment that was fleeting and a transference. And it was at a very particular time, which I actually want to go back a little further before we get there, if it's all right, to talk a bit of history. When you were a kid in New Jersey, were you considering yourself an artist? Like, at which point did you go, this is what I do, this is all I know how to do?
No, not when I was a kid. But it's very clear, you know, like I really, really wanted to be a basketball player. I mean, really, like when I was very young, like it stopped early, but, you know, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, I was very serious about it. I wanted to be professional. I was never good enough to be, but regardless, that's like, that was where all of my focus was. But I was also like, I've always had a horrible authority complex. I mean, you know, just like really bad. And, you know, I've been mad, learned to kind of contain it, but I still feel its rumblings.
I can relate,
but,
yeah.
You know, when I was introduced to skateboarding, it really spoke to me. You know, like I always had a problem with coaches. They were more, no different than principals or cops, mm-hmm. or whatever. And so this idea of this kind of freedom of a kind of expression that came with skateboarding and just a different kind of socializing that came with it really interested me. And so, you know, that's something that really kind of consumed my life for a while. I was always drawing, and, you know, it was always something that like where I was recognized as having some sort of kind of talent at and enjoyed, and didn't enjoy much else in school, you know. So there was this point where I in high school, I was a bit of an outcast, and I made friends with some of the kind of like older kids, and one of them introduced me to life drawings, like life drawing classes. It's just not something I knew about and never had any kind of like real formal kind of training. And so I did that, and I really took to it. That was like what opened up the possibility of it to me, my imagination to it. I started taking classes at Art Students League. And after my sophomore year in high school, I went to a summer program at Cooper Union, which was like an amazing experience. And, you know, I think that was really the point where I kind of knew that that's what I wanted to do. Funny though, and it's so much different now, even it's been so much different for a while, but like by the time I got to college, I think that like our generation is really at this kind of tipping point, like pre post internet, yeah. You know,
we didn't have an email address when we got to school.
No, definitely not.
Yeah. At RISD, right?
Yeah. At RISD. Yeah. There were some kids who were kind of sophisticated, who understood what contemporary art was and maybe understood what it meant to be an artist. And my father offered me some very interesting kind of like experiences, but I didn't, you know, I was naive. Like I had no clue of what it meant to be an artist. Like when I showed up at school and I didn't know who, you know, many of the like most important contemporary artists was. My dad taught me a little bit about some of like the generation prior, like in his own research, trying to like make it out of the small community he came out of. You know, he kind of found art and educated himself, but it was really Jasper Johns and Cy Twombly and things like that were things that he pushed himself to understand and shared with me. But yeah, I had no clue of what it meant to be an artist, but I did know I wanted to spend my time making art.
Mm. And then how did you get to New York City from RISD?
Well, you know, like I grew up right across the George Washington Bridge, and my whole family, except for our unit, stayed in Brooklyn. And so, you know, everything happened between Jersey and Brooklyn. And so we spent a lot of time in the city. And then skateboarding, I was always in the city. And I met Ryan McGinley when I was 13 or 14. And so we spent a lot of time skateboarding together. And he was 2 years older than me, that I think. Anyways, he came to college. He was going to Parsons, and I would visit him a lot. And then my summers at RISD, I would actually just stay asleep on his couch during the summers. By the time I graduated, I moved on to that couch, sadly enough. Truly lived, you know, lived in this like closet room that had a couch. And
did you have a studio to work in? Or you
yeah, my family, like I said, was still in Brooklyn, and my grandfather had an antique shop that he had just walked out of one day, and it was a bit of a junk shop, you know, on Coney Island Avenue. It was like in the 80s and 90s, there was like a lot of these kind of stores out mm-hmm. there. They were like antique junk kind of shops. And he basically walked out of his after decades of it kind of just filling up. And I like moved in there, which was, it was a crazy first studio, but you know, it was free and my living situation was almost free. And it allowed me to make work. You know, I actually sold two paintings to a drug dealer that went to our school and basically had no rent. And so I was able to like make the first body of work in a really kind of like fortunate set of circumstances.
Which was really laborious work.
Yeah.
And I was curious about that moment, that first body of work. What was the labor about? Because over time it changed, you know?
Yeah, it's funny to think about it because really I'm not the craftsman anymore, you know? I work with a lot of crafts that I feel like I know very well. I wouldn't say I'm an expert of anything really, but like, you know, I do design the methodologies behind a lot of things that I work or work very, very closely with experts and engineers to try to make their thing do what's in my mind, you know? So like still it really brings me into the fold and it's very much about being a part of the exploration. But those paintings, and although I had these kind of like high school art experiences, I really didn't spend much time oil painting. It was much more drawing. Then in college, I got this idea, you know, I saw some grad students and I was like, I'm never touching a brush again. I'm like, everything is going to be without a hand. And I started spraying and learning how to spray and stencil. And that's really what college was about. I didn't pick up a brush at all.
Mm.
And when I got out of school, I set up the studio and I was spraying these paintings, which we're talking about. And I got to a very early place in the work and I was like, oh shit. Like I was never good at spraying also. Like, by the way, I just like figured out how to do it, but it was like very hard for me and very slow, very, very slow. A lot of like backwards and forwards, making mistakes. But I got to a point really quickly where I couldn't do what I needed to do. And I was like, I may have to paint this with a brush. But then I had very little experience and I hadn't picked up a brush in many years. So I called all my friends. I said, how do you paint? The real advice that I got was like, get good tools, you know, mm-hmm. because like at least they'll do some of the work if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so I would steal an amazing amount of paint and brushes from Pearl Paint, a big part of that first show with Rivington Arms was like my trips to Pearl Paint. But I got all the best, you know, the natural hair brushes and the great paint. And I just taught myself how to paint. And so I sat in that studio for 2 years and I taught myself how to paint. And those paintings have like four or five paintings underneath them because there was like a level that I needed to get them to. What's important to pull out of that is that like, in the long run, what became, I think, important to my practice was not necessarily the fact that I'm sitting and painting, but that like there's a process or like an evolution of education within the work.
Right.
It was almost important that I stop painting because I felt like I was able to do it as well as I needed to. And like the idea of like a virtuoso or kind of a masterpiece seemed irrelevant to me. Education being a part of the process became very important to me.
Yeah, well, it has to do with time and shift and change. Like, that needs to be embodied in the work.
Right. And, like, actually seeing the kind of comfortability, seeing the skills and the craft develop within a single work or within a single body of work, discovering like the process and having evidence of that becomes very important to how I work.
And of course, your lifestyle at the time was super well documented. You know, you were, for people that don't know, it's now referred to as the Bowery School, I guess. And it was you and an extraordinarily talented group of friends that were sort of living your work in a way, living your life, but all very different work. How were you influencing each other, do you think? How, you know, you look at these, the core crew of you guys, which is Ryan, you and Dash Snow, of course, late Dash Snow. How is it that the three of you made such wildly different work, but spent so much time together?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, I think, part of the beauty of it. And what helped me see it, you know, when I met Nate Lohman and Adam McEwen and Banks Violet and Terrence Coe and Gardar, when the kind of circle kind of opened up a little bit, I think it was through those relationships that I was kind of like able to see something with Ryan and Dash more clearly. But like, you know, really what it was we were kids. We didn't know what it meant to be an artist. There was no strategy. There was no plan. There was our relationship, our friendship, you know, our intimacy. So, you know, I don't know, you know, yeah. But like, but it's, I think it's an important thing. And like, and at the time it felt disjointed and like, it was hard for me to see how influential we were in each other. There were like moments that stood out, but you know, in retrospect, I've obviously benefited from dialogue and experiencing other people's works and practices in huge ways. So many people and so many important people, but nobody like Dash or Ryan, you know, and again, truly different, very different work.
But all super focused on the personal. Yeah. You know, the work may have looked different or may continue to look different, but there is this sort of boldness and courage to explore self and the limits of self, which you did for those years in extraordinary ways. And it was, of course, Ariel Levy wrote that New York Magazine article, which I hadn't thought about. And in prepping for today, I went back and read it. And, you know, I realized the photographs were taken by Cass Bird right there on the High Line at, before the High Line was the High Line. It was this sort of mythology or whatever that was coming out. You know, what I was curious about when I read it was, how did that feel? Did it feel like you were reading about yourselves? Did it feel like you were reading about a character they didn't understand? Like, what was that experience like? Because that, in many ways, exposed you guys out of the Bowery, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a big thing. I mean, we were on the cover of New York Magazine in our, like, truest kind of state, which was just, like, disheveled and piled up on top of each other, you know? And I'm actually, I'm going on record about this. It's nice to have an opportunity because, you know, it was a different experience for everybody involved. And I would say I was in the middle. For Dash, it was a horrible, horrible experience. You know, I think for Ryan, it was much less complicated and much more just kind of like about building a career. And I would say I was somewhere stuck in the middle. But like the article turned into really a, being more focused on Dash, you know? It had most curiosity about him in a way. And I don't think it started out like that.
Well, it was almost like it was after something.
Yeah.
Like there was an ambition in that story, whereas there was just a description in a way of the other two. Like with Dash, it was like about his family. And
right.
Is there something to uncover?
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
it was
yes.
Sort of noodly in
totally.
That way.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, I think it was really hard for Dash. You know, Dash was always trying to find a distance from his family. He was always trying to define himself and separate from that.
But for you, it wasn't a totally negative experience.
It wasn't a totally negative thing, but this is the only thing that stands out to me that I want to, that I do want to say.
Yeah.
What's wild about that, you know, it ended up being, I think, like a kind of negative piece. You know, it was really, it was not a takedown piece. We were children. But like, you know, it was like...
It was a bit, who do you think you are?
Yeah, yeah. And a bit uncompassionate, I think, and unforgiving, and really kind of like decided to kind of look at from like a kind of negative standpoint instead of kind of looking for the beauty in it. Anyways, what's really strange is like, you know, I didn't hear about her for a while, but then she came back up in the press because she wrote this book about her mother. I don't know if you heard about it at all. So she was on NPR. Like, it was a big thing.
Yeah.
And her mother, I think, was a socialite and an alcoholic and a terror.
Yeah.
And she had this really, really complicated, I didn't know any of this, but like this really complicated relationship with her mother. And it was like,
this like identical to Dash's. And she was so uncompassionate. And like, it was just a really interesting thing. And again, just
that's
like
transference.
Just thinking about like all of those things, you know, like how
who is that article about?
Yeah, who is that article about? No, it's so weird. And like the way we can have like compassion for others and not for ourselves.
The blind
and,
spots.
It's kind of sad because there was something so much more interesting there, and there was an experience for the two of them to have that could have been much.
Well, that's
much
what struck
more.
Me is that there is that like if an anthropologist or a philosopher, social scientist had looked at what was happening, the more interesting draw would have been: this is a reflection of what's happening in this moment politically.
Right.
This is, you know, connected to a period of New York.
Right.
This is a response to the advent of technology. There was so much happening that when looking at it through that lens can be seen.
Well, I mean, I think maybe, I'm just seeing this now. I think she was more a part of the story. And what needs to happen is an anthropologist needs to look at it because there's also at the time, you know, where like I think things were changing in feminist politics. I think it's always been really hard for people to understand like my crew's kind of sexuality and like relationship to sex and gender and all these things. And Dash, the most so. I mean, he was like fluid in so many ways.
And used fluid in so many ways.
And used fluid in so many ways. Yeah, definitely, definitely. And so she was really a part of that stew, you know?
Yeah.
And it much more clearly in retrospect. And it would be an interesting thing, you know, including her as a character in it to kind of like consider that moment and everything that was happening.
That's the film.
Yeah.
It's about her writing the New York Magazine article.
Exactly.
So I wanted to get to the Ness Project, which is sort of this incredible part of art history. I think that it's a moment of kind of collaborative work about raw primordial experience. How did that project start and how did it end up all the way to Deitch?
When I look back, The Nest is one of the most important works that has helped guide me with The Farm recently, you know, as a kind of reference point. The Nest, I would say, really kind of took shape on an early road trip Dash and I did together. We actually were driving down to Basel, like maybe it was the first or second year of Miami Basel. We didn't know what an art fair was. We didn't know where we were going. It was right after my first show, and Rivington Arms was doing NADA, the New Art Dealers fair. And kind of going back to some of the ways in which you kind of described what was important about our relationships with my friends is just like, it was just a way to create a stage to enact intimacy. You know, it was really a way, you know, whatever, like all socializing with your friends is, but this allowed, you know, your body to be more of a physical experience.
Describe what it is for people that don't know.
You know, so we would rent a hotel room and like a motel room. And, you know, I think an important part of it is we rationalized it. So what we would do is, you know, there's always phone books all over motels. Like usually there's a pile, you know, there's always one in the room, but usually you can find the pile in the janitor's closet or whatever like that. And so we would bring the phone books into the room and we would just spend all night, literally, you know, all night long ripping them up and turning it into what looked like a hamster's nest. But we would say to ourselves, you know, like, cause we felt like we thought we had a kind of compassionate relationship to somebody like the person who would have to clean up after us or something like that, you know, like to the maid or the hotel staff. And we were like, we're really actually not doing anything. It's no big deal. They're going to have to sweep and vacuum the room anyways, you know, it wasn't that simple, but like, it really was like, it was a conversation and just to kind of set the mood in a way. But in actuality, we would destroy the rooms completely. You know, it was also just like an ode to the classic hotel room massacre, you know, destruction,
rock star
kind of thing. And the night would go on and we did the first few just by ourselves. And it would just, you know, whatever. It was just hanging out, you know, but like there was an activity and the activity would kind of lead to more of a kind of physical experience and like, you know, really kind of ridiculous antics. But just with he and I, you know, it was just talking and hanging out and like just kind of being in there and building it, right? We were creating a thing, not just a performance, but we were physically transforming the space, you know, obviously doing different things to the furniture and whatnot. So as it developed, you know, it always had that kind of physical format. Sometimes water would get involved and we'd overflow bathtubs and kind of flood the spaces. We would bring in friends. We found some prostitutes just to bring in to kind of like do it with us. and just to like hang out, you know, just to kind of diversify the crowd. Like we'd just be walking back to a hotel room at 6 a.m. and be like, hey, do you want to come? We do, you know, like they're just like, okay. So, and then, you know, there was some sex that happened in them, some kind of like orgy kind of stuff, you know, kind of really the whole gamut, just from games to sex to
heavy drug use.
A lot of drugs, of course, yeah. A lot of drugs. But no, again, no intentionality, right?
Yeah.
And there was no consideration of like the space as a kind of creation or as a kind of creative experience or as a performance. It really wasn't like that, but Dash documented everything, you know, and so. In a way, those were artworks, you know, the documentation. And although, you know, I think of what is really kind of unique about Dash is like it took him a very long time before he was willing to call it art, whatever it is that he did.
It's no surprise. I mean, given...
Yeah, he wanted to kind of defy his roots, and I think that didn't do that. And also he wanted to kind of defy commodity and markets, and he really tried to give away his work and the idea of kind of selling something really in a way... He was kind of very sensitive to that.
And eventually it became a proper exhibition.
So what happened is, you know, we did it a few times and like, you know, people heard about it and like we were invited by magazines too. I think we did a big thing for Vice, which was like kind of like got co-opted by them and was like really, I don't think like they shared the real experience of it. But, you know, it was documented well and Ryan was there for that. And also for that, actually, we brought 6 parakeets in, which then like lived with us for a while.
And we should remind people, just for context, that Vice was not a media conglomerate.
No, definitely
Vice
not.
Was a small little store.
Yeah. They had just moved from Toronto. It was a free magazine. They had a little shop on the Lower East Side. No, it was totally different. Pretty amazing, actually, that you know, to think about them in the story, because they are a part of the story. You know, Ryan was really a big part of it. And they covered Iraq in an early time. But yes, we had 6 parakeets. They were named Saddam 1 through 6. And, you know, it's a nice anecdote. Then they came back. We fled. We had to flee that hotel. And we threw them in a duffel bag. And I remember running out through the kitchen with parakeets in a duffel bag.
This is in London.
It did happen in London. But this was in New York, actually, for the Vice one. And then they lived in my, mine and Ryan's, you know, like they lived on the...
The rafters.
The fire, the sprinkler system for like a few weeks until my girlfriend's dad decided to take them, adopt them. But so it became more of a public thing or more of a known thing. And Jeffrey Deitch reached out to us. And I remember going to his gallery and with Dash. And Dash was like much more skeptical of the meeting. But Jeffrey was always real kind of believer in Dash's work and in my work and had shown that prior to this meeting. So we went and we listened to him. And, you know, he had this idea. It's like, you know, this nest, this amazing. And I think you guys should do it in the gallery. And we kind of just listened to him. And, you know, when we left, it was really like, that's crazy. Like, why would we do that in his gallery? It doesn't make any sense. And we weren't calling it art. And we had talked about that afterwards. And then I think we were like, well, but it would be an amazing opportunity to do a nest, you know, regardless of what a nest is, an art gallery, hotel room, whatever. It's just like a bigger, better space. And we came up with these very kind of strict parameters that we do it in. And we said that like he couldn't come. We'd want the gallery for like a full week. We want the keys to the gallery. And like he obliged, but like one of his staff was meant to oversee it, this young woman that we were friends with. And so that's what happened. You know, we got the keys. God bless Jeffrey. You know, like, I mean, he is one of the most important people in our generation's art world. You know, so a show like Posthuman and some of the early things that he did, it just like really shaped the art world as we know it. But like, you know, something like this is like, it's not even like today. I mean, today, like, you know, the idea of like this happening in Hauser and Wirth is like, is beyond ridiculous. But even then it was crazy, you know, the biggest fire hazard. I mean, we had butane torches in there. We were pissing in it. You know, it was just like a fucking mess. And then we did opening and closing parties, and it was a really kind of amazing experience, you know, and we brought a lot of our friends in and in a way opened it up to the community, which it really hadn't been before. And it was, I don't know how to put it into words, but it was really special, you know, and, you know, people should look at the images as that were the result of it, because like, you know, the space was kind of turned into something really special, I think.
Yeah.
And it's one of the works I'm most proud of and obviously kind of most sentimental about.
There's one the one that comes to mind is a very quiet one, sort of at the end with the light coming through the
skylight. Yeah, it was documented beautifully.
Yeah. Amazing.
And you know, like, I mean, you know, Gang Gang Dance played in it, Suicide played in it, which was just like amazing. And Purian played in it. It's just like the shows that we did were really fucking amazing. You know?
And at the same time, you were making like totally different kind of work. And
yeah, at the same time. I mean, again, my work was probably like least stable then, you know, it's kind of like really kind of transitioning in a way.
Do you think of that as kind of the peak moment of this sort of unhinged, or
I think it was like the highlight. I think it was all downhill from there in a way. I mean, sadly, you know, like Dash's daughter was born on one of the nights, like one of the kind of like important nights we were there. Things in retrospect became much harder after that. They were less celebratory after that, I would say.
And Dash passed away.
It was like 2 years after that.
2 years after that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that experience was traumatizing and is a whole podcast.
Right.
So I would like to just push through to the show Akagoshin in 2010, which was in a way how you process that experience.
Yeah.
Were you aware in making that show that that was what you were going to deal with? Was it hard to come to that? Like, how did you think about that? I mean, huge opportunity. Like, let's just like set the table. Like,
yeah.
24th Street.
Yeah. That was a very big show, and I was still pretty young. I had just gotten sober. For that show, I was thinking about Dash, and the confetti paintings are about Dash, like definitely, directly about Dash, and about the nest, and about this idea of freezing time, you know, which we talked about early on with my work. I think that the confetti paintings were about this idea where it's like you can freeze a moment. And like on one side of that moment, it's ecstasy and joy and celebration. And literally, once you play the tape, you could stop it at a moment where literally you end it on that. And when you start it again, you're in a totally different space.
Yeah.
You know, that's how emotions are. But like, that's how some times in our lives are, right? You move from pure joy and celebration to like devastation, terror, trauma. And that's like a real experience, you know, and those paintings are definitely about that.
You were met by a brick wall when you walked into that show.
Right.
Which was a sort of, I'm not sure what it was about or what the intention was. I know how it felt to me.
Mm-hmm.
What was the thinking by this sort of brick wall?
Right. So I wasn't ready to engage like a narrative that like really looked directly at Dash, which is something that I came to do soon after that. And like, I don't really know like if I have fully processed that yet. But I attempted that in the shows that kind of followed that. And I think that that's like a hard thing to attempt. And I think in a way those shows suffered because like I was so intentional about, it was more of that. It was more of processing a loss than it was of making art in a way. You know, it was more of a performance, more
the
of a process.
The top of motorcycles.
Well, no, I'm saying that show was, I would say, more pure art. And that show is really like, I think one of my strongest shows. And because I wasn't ready to like engage it directly. That show, looking back on it, was very much about that experience. But like, I can't really explain any of those pieces to you.
Right.
Because they were like pure creation. And like, that show was 9 months after I got sober and after I came into rehab. And I started building that show 4 months before it. And I had the ideas for that show like 5 months before it. And I remember when I shared it with the people I work with at Akagoshin, it's amazing, honestly, that they stepped up and helped me to make that show, because it's a ridiculous show. And, you know, it's funny, my reputation has preceded that show in many ways in this way of like a market artist and like a Gagosian artist, which is like crazy, because like that was the show that defined that. And there was nothing there anybody could ever buy, own, or sell.
Yeah. And harsh criticism. I mean, Roberta Smith responded in what I thought was a quite unfair way. She was seeing the work as very literal, where it actually was very open, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think in that show is like a very kind of poetic show.
Yeah.
And also like, I mean, like,
it was,
you know,
called poetry.
It was called poetry. That show was about miracle for me in a way, you know. The show was a great experience for me. And it's hard for me to talk about what it is, but obviously that wall is, you know, it is what it is, right? It's a relic, but it's also a kind of monument, and it's a barrier. You know, what I was doing with that wall, I think, was it was the most immediate kind of reference was the Western Wall, and just like a place to mourn and a place to believe and a place to pray and a place where somehow miracle can happen, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an important part of it.
And then in 2014, the show at the Brandt Foundation called Help. what was truly a memorial to Dash Snoke.
Yeah, that was, I think there was more there directly, yeah. There was a piece there that was actually that, the outdoor sculpture.
Yeah, which is the one I want to talk about. Yeah. It's 2 14-foot box trucks set up vertically. They kind of look like a Twin Towers.
Yeah.
And it was entitled, At Least They Died Together After Dash.
Right, yeah.
In the parenthetical. It's obviously deeply personal, but somehow, for me, it's emblematic of your ability to be in the micro and the macro at the same time. Because having no relationship to Dash, having no relationship to any of the story, one could view it simply as the Twin Towers.
Right.
Were you thinking at that time about that, or was that just sort of an outgrowth of it?
No, that was important. So he had a collage, which I've lived with. I've always lived with. It's like one of the, I own a lot of his work, and he mailed me, like, he put so much crazy shit in the mail that I have that's all actual artwork. But this was really the thing where I saw him make it and I was like, I want that, you know, that really kind of stands out as most that thing. And so I live with it, and it's like a New York Post page where he collaged over, it was the title was At Least They Died Together. I don't even know what's behind it, but what the picture looked like. But he put over like this kind of pulp magazine, a picture of these two naked men like hanging on to a cliff, like the cliff edge of a waterfall. And it's an amazing piece. And Amy Winehouse happens to be on the page also. And there's something like about Madonna. It's like an amazing New York Post page. So that's where the title comes from. And that piece is complicated for me because, like, you know, the kind of suggestion for me is, or like, there's the fantasy, which is like of dying, right? Of dying like with him,
mm-hmm.
which obviously didn't happen. And really, in a way, you know, I feel very indebted to and grateful for like a series of experiences and people who came in and really saved my life, because there's like a different narrative which I wouldn't have lasted very long in, you know. And so Dash is one of them, you know, and his, it's really like, it's in his absence that he was able to be so. And really, it's like, that's not even fair, because it's really like in his daughter that I think really had the impact on me, because, you know, we lost a lot of friends and we're still able to kind of romanticize death. And I think, you know, nobody who I was as close to as him, so I couldn't tell you what the experience would have been like had he not had a daughter. But like, I think my experience of his loss was shaped by like his daughter's presence in my life. So when I first had the idea, it was just of a truck. And then something about it just made me think of the collage and the idea of these kind of two trucks, these lovers or these kind of soulmates or something like that. And then, you know, I think the idea of the Twin Towers came up very quickly from there. The gist of the piece is that the cab of the truck is buried under earth, but the whole backside of it, the trailer of it, or the box of the truck is above ground, and it's been installed this whole time. So like really what it's meant to kind of create its own ecosystem inside of it. And so like it not only is life, but it's expanding life in a way. The space is meant to be taken over by nature.
Hmm. It also deals, and I'm just thinking about this now, with some sense of survivor, which is something that relates to the Jewish tradition and this idea that we talked about with your dad.
Yeah.
And this, not survivor guilt necessarily, but survivor awareness.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that's, I guess, what I was getting at with this idea of the kind of fantasy of not being a survivor, which is, that is what that experience is this understanding that like, it could have been you, but it's not. And so what do you do with that?
Yeah, what's your responsibility beyond that? And the next body of work, and the last one I was most interested in talking about a little bit, is Help, the Seascapes, which is actually about something that feels very different,
mm-hmm.
this sort of vastness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if that, obviously it could have only happened in that time and in this moment in your life where you mm-hmm. were making those paintings, but were you curious about this idea of like journey and now I'm moving beyond? As if that show sort of not closed up that period, but there was the next thing.
Well, just like in, you know, what it is and where my practice is at right now, really what happened is I made these candle paintings, and I started in 2003-04, and I made the last ones around 2009. I really wanted to make a bigger series of them, but they were painstaking and really took me a long time. And as I was making them, I kind of like generated all these ideas for these kind of bodies of work that came after them. And when I began the non-traditional material works, I never imagined that it would be a 10-year cycle. So in those 10 years, it really made it hard for me to make these actual oil paintings that I wanted to, which were all these landscape paintings that were Disney paintings that kind of came out of the candle painting, which was an image of Geppetto's work table. I tried to make them in that time, but I was kind of so focused on the non-traditional material works and other works I was developing. The oil paintings take total concentration.
Yeah.
And so about 5 years ago, I kind of decided to really refocus on them, but almost didn't do it in a focused enough way where I had these three bodies of work I tried to explore at once. And so right now I'm actually finishing these large scale oil paintings, which I call mother paintings, which the help paintings really complement and they're really a part of. And it's about journey. And the mother, and so these are the paintings that are really coming out of 2009, you know, and I desperately want to finish them because like, I do feel like I'm ready to like begin a totally new chapter. And I think this play that I mentioned is a big part of it. And so the help paintings were a little, you know, smaller scale, less ambitious and easier to resolve than these bigger paintings, but they're all really kind of a part of the same work. The mother paintings are kind of landscape on land, but really kind of like explore the space between, let's say, the coziest interior of a home and the kind of like most depraved corner of a jail cell. And then all the space in between. So there's like a lot of landscape. Some of it is kind of dark landscape and some of it is very bright and hopeful landscape. A lot of you're on the kind of edge of something. So you're looking towards like a hometown or you're looking into the dark forest. And the help is, it's part of the same narrative, but it's the expanse. It's the generalization of that expanse between the home and the jail, or, you know, the security and the horror.
And it has a very strong relationship when I've seen and hearing you talk about it to Wyeth's Christina's World and this relationship to this home and then this.
That's so funny. Yeah.
This sort of dragging up the hill.
Yeah, I've never. I mean,
have you ever seen that painting in person?
Yeah, because it's at the MoMA.
Yeah, it's at the MoMA. Yeah.
I mean, that, yeah, it's an amazing painting. What is a great reference? I love that. That's so funny. I've never thought about that, but it's the perfect reference point.
And in many ways, it seems like you're able now to look at this because, you know, Wyeth really was immersed in landscape, and he was responding to deeply universal issues through his personal relationship to landscape. They're deep and they're about experience and time and all of these things. And it seems like as he got further and further into his career post Helga and things, he was exploring more of that. I'm standing here like any human. This is like the primordial view. So it's interesting what happens as you move further in your career. Do you become less representational, more focused on emotional touch points and things?
Mm-hmm, right.
Anyhow, we covered amazing ground.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for spending time with us today, sharing insights. It's really fascinating to hear your perspective on your life and work.
Definitely, man. Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Extra thanks to our season 3 sponsor, Alanga and Zuna. Alanga and Zuna's watchmakers are characterized by diligence, patience, artistry, a pursuit of innovation, and the persistent belief that everything is possible, followed by the ambition to achieve it. You can find out more about Alanga and Zuna at www.alange-soehne.com. And thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of the Time Sensitive Podcast on our website, timesensitive.fm, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv.